We are hugely honoured to welcome this week Professor Rabbi Marty Lokshin, who is Professor Emeritus at York University, currently living in Jerusalem, who has a strong background in Near Eastern and Judaic studies, where he received a PhD from Brandeis University and his rabbinic ordination in Israel while studying at Yeshivat Merkaz HaRav Kook. Among Marty's many publications is his four-volume translation and annotation of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. We are hugely excited to have you, Marty, here to explore with us Parsha Vayishlach. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Today we're talking about Parshat Vayishlach, the continuation and the end of the story about the relationships, the troubled relationship between Yaakov and Esau, between Jacob and Esau. 2 weeks ago, we saw how their relationship did not get off on a very good start. There was a story about Jacob buying the birthright from Esau, and then there was a story of Jacob stealing the blessing from Esau, the blessing from his father. When the last time that these two characters were together, Esau is saying, "I'll just wait until my father dies and I'll kill my brother." Rivka, their mother, hears about this, tells Jacob that it would be a good idea to run away and to go to her brother's home in Haran. And she says, "I'll tell you when it's safe to come home." Curiously, she never does, or at least the Torah never records that Rivka sent word to Yaakov, to Jacob, that it was safe to come back. But God tells Jacob to come home to the land of Israel. And that's what happens in this week's parsha. Jacob is coming to the land of Israel, and we read at the beginning of this week's parsha, "Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lefanav leisav achiv arza seir sedei adom." Jacob sent messengers ahead to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he instructed them as follows: "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I stayed with Laban, and I remained there until now. I have acquired cattle, asses, sheep, and male and female slaves. And I send this message to my lord, limtzo chen be'enecha, in the hope of gaining your favor." So these messengers go off and then they come back. I assume that most of the people listening to this podcast know the basic story, but I just want to emphasize what actually the text says. And then we'll talk about two different interpretations of the text, the standard interpretation of the text in Jewish tradition, and the extremely interesting against-the-grain interpretation of the same text that was offered by one medieval Jewish commentator. We'll say more about that in a second. Just this message is sent off to Esau. The messengers return to Jacob saying, "Banu el achicha el Esau, v'gam holech likratecha v'arba meot ish imo." The messengers return to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau. He himself is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Vayira Yaakov me'od vayetzer lo. Jacob was greatly frightened, and he was sad about this. And then he goes into all sorts of actions. He tries different strategies, dividing up his camp into different units, sending an expensive gift to Esau in an attempt to change Esau's mind. Then we have the strange occurrence before they actually meet each other. Yaakov suddenly finds himself by himself, and then he's fighting with an angel, and he gets injured by the angel, but he does not succumb to the angel. And then he meets Esau, and when he meets Esau, he bows down to him seven times, and Esau runs up and kisses him. The standard Jewish understanding of this text is that Esau was actually coming to kill Jacob. that that was what was happening, just as he said that he would be doing, and that Jacob tried all of these strategies, and something from these strategies worked, and Esau changed his mind. A number of the commentators make this very clear. This is the standard explanation of the story that we have always learned back in kindergarten or wherever we first studied the story. Ramban, the great commentator in the 13th century, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, writes, I'll just read it in the English translation here, "This story was written to teach us how God saved Jacob and redeemed him from the hand of someone stronger than him." The story of Esav coming to kill Yaakov, and then God helped him. Ulamdenu od, and Ramban says, and there's something else that we should learn from the story. Shehu lo batach betzidkato vihishtadel bahatzalato b'chol yecholto. But the story also teaches us that Jacob did not simply rely on his own righteousness and assume that God would save him, but he made independent efforts on his own behalf. Ramban, like many Jews, saw this story as a hint for subsequent generations about how we should deal with Esav. And Esav was understood by many of the Jews in the Middle Ages as meaning Christendom. Jews who lived in Christendom, like Ramban, saw that this is a model for how we should try to deal with our hosts here in these countries who often have negative attitudes towards us. It's appropriate for us to act in the same manner that that righteous man acted. Ra'ui lanu la'achoz bedarko shel tzadik. שנזמין עצמנו לשלושה הדברים שיזמין הוא את עצמו, לתפילה ולדורון ולהצלה בדרך מלחמה לברוח להינצל. It's appropriate for us to act in the same way, using the same three forms of action that Jacob used in the beginning of this parasha. He used prayer, he used bribery, and he used battle preparations. In other words, Ramban, who doesn't know about Jewish armies, the 13th century, says battle preparations. That means preparing to run away and thus escape. So those are all the things that Jacob did. And we should learn from this in dealing with the Christians who are our enemies today. Rashi, in his commentary, goes in the same direction without coming right out and learning a lesson about how one should be behaving. Rashi, the most famous, many people would say the greatest of all the Jewish Bible commentators, writing in the 11th century, writes that when the messengers came back to Jacob, they said, "Banu el achicha el Esav, we came to your brother, to Esau. We came to the one whom you call your brother, but he isn't behaving like a brother. He is behaving like evil Esau. He still hates you." Hu noheg imcha ke'esav harasha, odenu b'sinato. So that is the standard Jewish understanding of seeing Jacob as the prototype for the Jewish people, dealing with enemies, the people who don't like the Jews. And Jacob tried these strategies. And because he used these strategies and because God was on his side, that is why he was saved. So far, I don't think I've said anything at all controversial. And I've just offered the standard interpretation that I think you can find in almost every synagogue and almost every Jewish school. However, one Bible commentator in the Middle Ages, Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, Rashi's grandson, who was perhaps one of the most creative interpreters of the Bible, writing in the 12th century, came up with a totally different understanding of the text. I have a particular interest in Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, and I often use his commentary on the story of Jacob and Esau as a way of demonstrating what his methodology actually is. So he shocks us in the beginning, where he just says that when Jacob receives the message, "Banu el achicha el Esav," the messengers reported, they don't actually say what Esav said. Rashi said, "He's acting like evil Esau. He still hates you," implying that he's still coming to kill you. Rashbam says that what the messengers actually reported was, "Banu el achicha el Esav, umatzata chen be'enav ka'asher amarta." And actually, you had said, I'm sending word to you, Esav, limtzoh chen be'einecha, in order to find favor in your eyes. And the messengers came back and said, actually, you did find favor in Esav's eyes. And Rashbam points out that there are two stories in the Torah of brothers who haven't seen each other for a long time, meeting after that long time when they didn't see each other. There's the story here of Jacob and Esau, and there's the story of Aharon and Moshe, of Aaron and Moses, who meet up after a long time that Moses was in Midian. And Rashbam points out that the language here of this meeting is the same language that's used in that other story. He writes, Gam hinehu mitoch shesameach bebiyatcha uva'avato otcha holech likratcha. Because he's happy that you are coming, and because he loves you, he is coming to greet you. Holech likratcha, which is the same language that is used when God tells Moses that Aaron is coming to meet you. He says to Moses, Gam hinehu yotze likratcha, he's going out to meet you. Beracha v'samach b'libo. That the message that Jacob received was that Esav actually is not out to kill him, but Jacob didn't believe. Jacob, even though Rashbam goes on to say, God had told Jacob to come back to the land of Israel, had promised him that he would protect him. I'm going to be with you. I will protect you. But he didn't trust this. So we have here a story, according to Rashbam, of Jacob, who is coming back to the land of Israel, who sends a message to his brother, gets at best an ambiguous message about his brother, but Rashbam says you can read this as a positive message that he received about his brother. And then, despite this, he took all sorts of steps to try to deal with a danger that didn't exist, including, says Rashbam, when it says in the continuation, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, that Jacob was left by himself. It says that Jacob was taking his entire family and his entourage across the river. And then it says that he was by himself. Wait a second, how could he be by himself? Well, the Midrashim and Rashi try to come up with all sorts of explanations why he is by himself. Rashbam says it's simple why he's by himself. He was running away. And when he was running away, God sent an angel to stop him from running away and to cause him, to delay him in his attempt to run away and to injure him for trying to run away when he shouldn't be running away. And then after he was delayed in this way by the angel and he is limping because of the encounter with the angel, then he goes to meet his brother who just wants to hug him and to kiss him. And that it wasn't that Jacob changed Esau's mind. We have a story here, Rashbam claims, of Jacob being afraid of his own shadow, being afraid when there's no reason for him to be afraid, and getting punished by God for not trusting that Esau would be friendly towards him. And Rashbam goes on and says that the pattern here of Jacob becoming injured is a pattern that appears in a number of biblical stories. I'll read it to you just in the English translation here. The reason that Jacob became lame was because God had made a promise to him, and yet he still was trying to run away. So also we concern all those who go on a path that God does not want them to follow, or who refuse to go on a path where God wants them to go. They are punished. After Moses said to God, Bi Adonai shlach na bi ati shlach, please, O Lord, don't send me on this mission to Egypt. It says that God became angry with him. And according to Rashbam, he says that means, how did God become angry at him? Because it says in the continuation, the Lord encountered him at the encampment and sought to kill him. So also Jonah, was swallowed up into the belly of the fish. He was told to go east, and he went west, and he was swallowed up into the belly of the fish. And so also concerning Balaam, it says that God was angry with him that he was going, and that is why he became lame. His foot got crushed between the donkey and the wall in the story of Balaam. My friend Rabbi Shmuel Klitzner many years ago pointed out to me that Rashbam here is identified for stories where the hero seems to be suffering in his leg or in his mobility. These are all stories of somebody being asked to go in a specific direction or not to go in a specific direction and going against the orders. And so this totally different understanding of the text that is proposed here by Rashbam. One last point about this story. There's a famous comment of Rashi in the continuation of the story. When they do meet, it says that Vayarotz Esav likrato vayishakehu, that Esav ran towards Jacob and kissed him. Rashi writes, vayishakehu nakudalav. The word vayishakehu, he kissed him, has dots over the letters of the word. And Rashi says there are two explanations in the Sifrei, in an old Midrash Halakha from the 3rd or 4th century about this. Some say that the dots mean that he didn't kiss him wholeheartedly. However, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says it is a well-known Halakha that Esav hates Jacob. Halakha hi biyadua. She'esav sone liYaakov. Ella shenichmeru rachamav ota sha'a u'neshako b'chol lipo. However, at that particular moment, he became merciful and he kissed them wholeheartedly. But of course, he continued to hate him. And this quotation from Rashi here, halacha biyadua she'esav sone liYaakov, is quoted in so many contexts now in the 21st century and texts from the 20th century of people who are convinced that what this story is teaching is that anti-Semitism is universal and inevitable. And that's what Rashi is saying here, that it's a halacha. It's something that doesn't change, just like halacha doesn't change, according to this understanding. So also, it is a halacha that Esav really hates Jacob. The problem is, though, that in the text that Rashi is citing and from the Sifrei, that isn't what the text says. There is a new critical edition of the Sifrei, of this Midrash Halacha, edited by Professor Menachem Kahana from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where he gathered together all of the medieval manuscripts of the Sifrei, and in only one of them, the manuscript that went to France, not surprisingly, does the word Halacha appear. And in all the other manuscripts, what the text reads is, Halo biyadua she'esav sone liYaakov. Didn't we know? Isn't that something that we knew, that Esav hates him? But actually, here, he didn't hate him. So there is no statement here of the inevitability and the universality of anti-Semitism. I'm not saying here that anti-Semitism isn't universal, isn't inevitable. I'm not taking a stand on this. But what I'm saying is that the attempt to turn this story into the story of our father, Yaakov, and his attempt to deal with the arch anti-Semite Esav, and the miraculous way in which God intervened in order to save him from this anti-Semite, that's a common reading of this story, but it is not necessarily the pshat of this story. Rashbam, to my mind, makes a strong case that actually the text is a text that is critical of Yaakov, critical of the behavior of Jacob, who ends up, as we find out, getting injured along the way, and then finds his brother, who is not interested in doing anything except kissing him and giving him. A very different reading of the text.
Marty, thank you so much for delivering those two very contrasting perspectives on the text. I really wonder whether you might share your thoughts around perhaps the purpose of the ambiguity that seems to be evident in the text itself that can lend to such different interpretation.
Good question. One of the aspects of studying biblical narrative that many people find frustrating, I actually enjoy it, is that there's so many biblical narratives that you read and you just don't really know afterwards who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. You read the story of Jacob stealing the blessing a couple of weeks ago in the parasha, and are you supposed to think that he did the right thing? Or are you supposed to think that he did the wrong thing? And even the story of purchasing the birthright, it is curious that the Bible, that is supposed to be a text, not just supposed to be, it is a text that is trying to teach us values and teach us behavior. It tells a lot of stories that can be interpreted in more than one way. And during most of Jewish history, I would say that the majority of interpreters looked for the interpretation that would serve the purposes of the Jewish community in the time that the commentary was being written. And I think Rashi's kind of interpretation and Ramban's kind of interpretation definitely serves the interests of the Jewish community in France of the 11th century or of Spain in the 13th century. What I find very attractive about Rashbam's interpretation is he seems to be just interested in the words and in explaining the words, and it's not actually, I don't believe for a second that Rashbam is trying to say, actually, there is no problem of anti-Semitism in the world. Actually, nobody's out to get us. We're all going to be fine. No, that's not what he's doing. He is trying to read the text, and he's trying to come up with an interpretation of the text that he thinks fits the words best, and he's willing to give an interpretation that's very different from what he learned when he went to kindergarten. I have no doubt that when Rashbam went to the equivalent of kindergarten in the 12th century, or at the end of the 11th century when he was young, he learned that interpretation that Esav was clearly coming to kill Jacob. And then he decided to read the text on his own. I see him as a kind of model for us for the possibility of looking at the biblical text and coming up with new understandings of the biblical text.
Thank you so much. I wonder maybe finally what you think. There are many fraught relationships right across Genesis, and I wonder how you see this relationship between Jacob and Esau in relation to all the other many fraught relationships.
Yes. Brothers don't get along very well with each other in Genesis, do they? I never had a brother.
I have three.
You have three. So maybe you can talk about this better than I. But Genesis does present the difficulty of the relationships between brothers. And the next relationship in the Parshiot that are coming up, in the Torah portions that are coming up, the relationship between Yosef and his brothers definitely continues this pattern. Nobody behaves very well in the story of Yosef and his brothers. There isn't the simple good guy and the simple bad guy in the story. Some people have read the story of Yosef as a story of growth of Yehuda, perhaps the growth of Yosef, a story of maturation. I'm not convinced that that's the way to read it. I think that the Bible is telling us many stories of fraught relationships between family members because, well, partially because many family relationships are fraught. And the simple decision to try to turn them into stories about good guys and bad guys, while that might seem to make them more, let's say, religious, to make them more into texts from which one can learn, I'm delighted that the Bible tries to teach us by telling stories in which there isn't like this simple or simplistic kind of message. Here's the good guy, here's the character with the white hat, and here's the character with a black hat, and here's the good guy, and here's the villain. Because very often in life, it isn't all that simple to divide people up into the good guys and the villains.
Thank you for guiding us through such complexity and giving us much food for thought. We have really enjoyed this today and do look forward to inviting you back.
Thank you very much. I'd love to come back sometime.
If you like this podcast, please remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, find out all about the exciting content that we have for you at our mothership at jewishquest.org. We look forward to seeing you again next week.